The thing about disasters is that they come upon us so unexpectedly and destroy everything we knew beforehand. There we are, busy getting on with our lives, filled as it is with the passions and intricate details of our existences, when suddenly, and without warning, something huge comes along and destroys everything we knew. In The Story of London, there is a huge disaster on its way, and the people in the city have no idea it's coming and are carrying on with their lives, oblivious to its imminent arrival. And what we see is a city coming to terms with many changes and persevering in the face of all this, as it's been doing for the decades previous to this moment. And yet, around them, the shade of a dark force was rising. In the battlefields of northern England and of northern France, in the corridors and chambers of Westminster, and upon the oblivious streets of London itself, death was about to stalk this land. But it was unseen and unsuspected. In those last few years, before the coming of the plague, London was to see itself lurch from possibly facing decades worth of political instability, to suddenly being the witness to the greatest glory ever displayed by an English king. No one could conceive what was just about to happen. A helter-skelter of a few years, which gave no hint of the inevitable full stop in the story ahead. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London. This podcast tries to do one thing, tell the history of the city as a single narrative tale, broken up into digestible chapters. The chapters themselves are split into larger sections, books, and we are now coming to the penultimate chapter of the fourth book, wherein the city watches as the nation around it comes within a hair's breadth of falling into identical patterns of political behaviour that had so plagued the realm all through this particular book of the story. But then it broke the cycle, and it offered the city a brief window of the hope of something new. Yet that window was closed with the inevitable coming of the plague. And so it's time to look back at the events in London and beyond for the 6 years between 1341 and 1347. Welcome then to the 121st chapter of The Story of London, Angels of Death. So we begin this chapter in 1341, and the truth was, well, at this point, the King's War with France was going incredibly badly, and London was needing to defend itself for fear of French invasion. As the 1340s start, we know the city was shoring up its defences, and we read in the records of the city, a massive rebuilding project upon the city's walls was commencing. Repairing the wear and tear of these ancient Roman walls was an expensive project. A new section of the city wall near Cripplegate was erected, repairing it at the cost of £10, 17 shillings and 4.5 pence. The Londoners also rebuilt Cripplegate itself, laid new pavement around it, and fitted a new kitchen within the gatehouse for a paltry £14, 7 shillings and 7.75 pence. New pavement was laid down around Aldersgate for 20 shillings and 4 pence, and the city covered the costs of two shops outside the city disrupted by the building walk and the damages done to six shops inside the city leading up to Aldgate for an additional £36 and 8 shillings or so. Meanwhile, new pavement was being laid down around Newgate. This was much needed infrastructure work, protecting that which was within, even at this immense cost. Now, do you remember the giant crossbows, or springalls, I mentioned a couple of chapters ago, along with the six cannons the city had purchased? well, they were not just for show. During this decade, the city's records show, quote, expenses incurred upon the Springalds guns and targets, as set forth in the roll, of £72, 17 shillings and 3.5 pence, unquote. So now we know just how much the city paid for these weapons. But the crucial thing here is the mention of targets. These giant heavy weapons were not just for show. They had men practicing upon them. Indeed, the same records go on to account, quote, for expenses upon the chamber of the Guild Hall for putting the targets there, 57 shillings and 6.5 pence, unquote. Here in the Guild Hall and around it, men were obviously seemingly practicing with these weapons, honing their skills in the event of an attack upon the city. The sound would have carried over the busy streets of London, no doubt, very easily. I know it seems strange to suggest it, that here in the 14th century, London became as familiar with the sounds of early cannons being fired as it was with church bells. But for reasons that would become obvious later on in this episode, I think they were. It's also worth noting that these early guns, the brass cannons they kept inside or under Guildhall, were not the most accurate of things. Crews would need considerable practice to have any hope of hitting anything. And as we know from two chapters ago, these were not the only military preparations taking place in London. We read of, quote, monies paid to John Lucas, the sheriff's clerk, by precept of the mayor, for the expense of driving piles into the water of the Thames and making a certain house, called the Britask, near the Tower of London, in the time of the war, unquote. For the shoring up of the river defences and the building of that fortified arsenal near the Tower of London seems to have cost London an additional £126 all told. Everything needed to be accounted for. As was said many times in the past, this war was incredibly expensive. The city began the decade under the steady and strong leadership of the pepperer Andrew de Audrey, who was mayor, leading into 1341, where the vintner John de Oxenford took office. However, after only a few months in charge, we read, quote, John de Oxenford, mayor of London, died at the hour of parish mass, and his death being announced to Roger de Defham, alderman and recorder, the same Roger immediately, on behalf of our Lord the King and of the commonalty, gave orders to Richard de Birking and John de la Roque, the sheriffs of the said city, that they should immediately, all other things set aside, by their sergeants, summon all the aldermen and the more wealthy and more reputable commoners of the city to appear on the same day, at the third hour at the latest, in the Guild Hall of London, there to elect a mayor in the place of the said John, who had gone the way of all flesh, unquote. The death of this vintner saw a mercer placed in the role, as the records say, quote, and on the same day the alderman and the more reputable commoners chose Simon Francis, alderman, to be mayor, who was immediately sworn in, as the usage is. And on Wednesday following, they presented said Simon, by them according to the custom of the city, to the treasurer and barons of the Exchequer at Westminster, unquote. So now a mercer ran the city for the rest of the year, and that was about to be the most exciting thing to happen with the mayors during this time. Of course, this change in mayor was taking place during an intense moment in national politics. And let me say, the national politics seemed to evoke shades of a very hazardous past. There was a real danger that once again the choice of London's mayor was going to become incredibly political again. And why? Well, if you remember from last chapter, we left the story was Edward III, with him turning up at the Tower in London, finding it unguarded, blowing a gasket, and then firing everyone as he accused the Regency government he'd left behind of basically leaving him too poor to run his war, and blaming above all the Archbishop of Canterbury for his financial woes, as opposed to, you know, accepting that he had personally bankrupted the country himself. London witnessed a sudden political crisis that threatened to return the nation to the same nonsense the King's father had inflicted upon it, as soon as King Edward III appeared back in the capital. The Archbishop of Canterbury returned back to his diocese and remained there during the entire winter of 1340 and 1341. With him away, the king's vitriol against this man increased. Over the new year, the Archbishop responded by delivering a fiery sermon in the cathedral, declaring his intention to be as hard-line in his dealings with the king as Thomas Becket. Not a good sign. The king and the Archbishop of Canterbury began issuing political rants at one another. Edward accused Archbishop Stratford of overspending at home while failing to supply his armies with sufficient funds to conduct the war. Stratford, in reply, said he would only answer such charges before the king, the prelates, and his peers in Parliament. And so a Parliament was summoned to Westminster, and once again London had a front row seat to the ensuing political drama. But when Parliament started towards the end of April 1341, King Edward did something extraordinary. He saw that two of his henchmen, men called John Darcy and Ralph Stafford, remained at the door of the Painted Chamber and stubbornly refused the Archbishop of Canterbury access to the Parliament for over a week. There was kind of a strange standoff. The Archbishop of Canterbury, in full regalia, sitting outside the chamber. Meanwhile, the King and the rest of Parliament is inside, and the King's trying to carry on as normal and, you know, ask the Parliament to authorise a new instalment of taxes, please. The representatives of Parliament were aghast. They were having none of this. I mean, the Archbishop of Canterbury is just there. This king was acting like his father. He's acting almost as bad as bloody King John. It is said that during the impasse, the Earl of Surrey declared, quote, "Sir King, how goes this Parliament? Parliaments were not wont to be like this. For here those who should be foremost are shut out, while there sit other men of low rank who have no business to be here. Such right belongs only to the peers of the land," unquote. King Edward soon discovered that the Earl of Surrey was not alone in feeling so strongly about this, and that actually most of his Regency Council were utterly aghast at his actions. This most dynamic of medieval kings realised then and there he was no Henry II, or rather, he was like Henry II, and was finding out that picking a fight with an Archbishop of Canterbury is not always a winning tactic. Edward basically was left with no option except to allow the Archbishop of Canterbury into the chamber and make his peace with him. But these events struck a nerve with the nobles and magnates of England. Very similar things had been inflicted upon them by his father. The lords declared that none of their rank should ever be arrested or tried or imprisoned except by a full parliament, and they should answer to their peers. At the same time, the commons in Parliament also seized the opportunity to voice their grievances. They were broke. The taxes were wrecking everything. And the commoners combined with the lords to demand a detailed public audit of the king's whole finances, and requested that the great officers of the realm should be appointed by the king in Parliament and be sworn therein to obey the law. Edward III had turned up filled with anger, fury, and self-righteous indignation, but he had not realised how much his wars had hurt the economy and sown the seeds for such united opposition against him. Certainly he had no choice but to give his hasty, if somewhat qualified, assent to all these demands, and solemn legislation was duly composed and written up on the statute roll. Laws which looked and sounded the same as those that had created the Lord's Ordainers. Indeed, there were a hell of a lot of similarities between the crisis of 1341 and the earlier crisis of 1311. The nation was distinctly and completely unhappy with the way the king ran England, at least in terms of his taxation policies. Edward III had been humbled and to a degree humiliated, and as the decade started, it did appear as if what had happened before would happen again, a long drawn out political war between the crown and the lords of England. But luckily for everyone, the years Edward had spent cultivating good relationships with the more powerful nobles of England now paid dividends. No lord sought to maintain hostility towards this king. There was a desire to aid him, and he had earned considerable goodwill for conceding as quickly as he did to their demands. Edward capitalized upon this. By the following October, he annulled all those laws passed earlier that year on the grounds that they had been forced upon him against his will. He was also able to isolate the Archbishop of Canterbury, and 2 years later, when the next Parliament met in 1343, the two men were reconciled. King Edward's III's survival of the political crisis of 1341 is not always appreciated for how big a thing it was. But that's only because some historians never really take into account just how awful things had been under his father, and how much on paper Edward III's regime could have gone the same way. Edward III showed serious political skill in not only nipping such a thing in the bud, but he ended up establishing a new era of political stability that was to last in England until 1360. The stench of political instability was cleansed from the realm. Speaking of stenches, in London by 1343, we see Mayor Simon Francis try to deal with a differing type of stench, with a misguided act to encourage public hygiene. Quote, "For the decency and cleanliness of the same city, granted upon leave to the butchers in the parish of St. Nicholas Shambles in London, a piece of land in the lane called Seacole Lane, near the water of Fleet, for the purpose of there in such water cleansing the entrails of beasts. And upon such piece of land, the butchers aforesaid were to repair a certain key at their own charges, and to keep the same in repair, they paying yearly to the Mayor of London for the time being at the feast of our Lord's Nativity, one boar's head," unquote. Yeah, so for the price of one boar's head to be delivered at every Christmas feast, the city provided the butchers of Newgate Street Shambles with a central place by the River Fleet where they were supposed to clean out the entrails of the animals they butchered. Now, this did succeed in removing the stench and gore from away from Newgate Street, but added to the already polluted River Fleet by Seacole Lane. And this made life even worse for the inmates of the nearby Fleet Prison, who now had then the stench of adding this to the River Fleet, which was already an open sewer. And then on top of this, there was the additional strong ammonia stench of the nearby tanneries. This combination of scents were overwhelming men in their cells. Talk about grim. Still, London suburbs were continuing to grow. By 1344, we see records that a house immediately behind St. Dunstan's in the West, in Fleet Street, was let by Robert de Clifford's widow to law students for a rent of about £10 per year. This house, Clifford's Inn, became an inn of chancery, a term thought to originate in the specialisation in the tuition of chancery clerks, men responsible for writs in the king's courts. Eventually, there were to be 8 chancery inns, none of which had the power to call students to the bar, but each became affiliated to one of the inns of court, in the case of Clifford's Inn, to the Inner Temple. These days, a single alley, Clifford's Inn's Passage, still runs from Fleet Street to the site of the old gatehouse of Clifford's Inn. Meanwhile, a year later, the selling of poultry in London was regulated. A proclamation was issued to men of the poultry trade who lived outside of London's walls. And it said that those who had previously, quote, sold their poultry in lanes, in the hostels of their hosts, or elsewhere in secret, to the great loss and grievance of the citizens and at extortionate prices, unquote, was that they were to now bring, quote, the same to the Leaden Hall, and there sell it, and nowhere else, on the pain of forfeiture of the poultry and going bodily to prison, unquote. With the establishment of the poultry market of Leadenhall, the mayor of that year, the mercer Richard de Lacer, was attempting to clear up regulation and trade in the city and to protect the city's traders. And this wasn't a one-off thing. In this era, we see London's records filled with long-running investigations into illegal fishing on the River Thames. Trades such as the cutlers and the girdlers and the pepperers forming alliances and communities and being given right to regulate their trade in the city to protect themselves from the ongoing difficult economic conditions. And while the Fleet River was being given over to stench and ruin, attempts were being made to save London's other waterways. Down at the Thames, one of the principal docks of the city, rivaling Billingsgate and Queenhithe at the time, was Dowgate, which no longer exists but was to be found west of Cousin Lane. In 1343, it was reported that Dowgate was so corrupted by dung and other filth thrown into it that the carters who carried water from the Thames to sell in different places in the city were unable to use it. A toll was inaugurated on goods coming through Dowgate to help pay for its cleansing. We read of a city where two tapestry makers, John de Bromholm and Richard Freery, brought before the mayor of London, quote, 10 false blankets that had been vamped in foreign parts with the hair of oxen and cows, and brought from these parts by Richard de Bois to the city for sale, unquote. Turns out these expansive blankets were an example of counterfeit or fake goods, and it was agreed, quote, that the same should be burnt beneath the pillory of Cornhill, and they were so burnt on the same day, unquote. And this process of regulating things carried on when the city decided to examine the men who make spurs, the spurriers. They were condemned by the city's authorities because, quote, many of their trade are wandering around all day without working at all, and then, when they have come drunk and frantic, they take to work, to the annoyance of the sick and of all their neighbourhood, as well as by reason of the broils that arise between them and the strange folks who are dwelling amongst them, unquote. Such behaviour is not acceptable in the crowded confines of the city, and new regulations as to how they should conduct their work were issued. Still, while London was busy being London, the situation nationally was changing. And while Edward had managed to overcome a political crisis, the military situation continued to be grim still. The king's lack of cash meant that all his allies in the Low Countries basically disappeared, and King Edward was deprived of his title of Imperial Vicar of the region. And then David Bruce returned to Scotland in 1341, which meant a renewal of cross-border raids and forced the English king to undertake a northern campaign in the winter of 1341 and 42. David Bruce managed to oust Robert Stuart as guardian of Scotland and successfully re-established the Scottish monarchy of the Bruce family, with whom Edward was forced to agree to a three-year truce in 1343. But at that exact moment, things began to change for King Edward. Across the Channel, the Duchy of Brittany fell vacant. The French king, Philippe, backed a man called Charles of Blois for the title. King Edward immediately backed the claim of John de Montfort for it, and this started what is now called the Breton War of Succession. And thus was born what became known as Edward III's provincial strategy. This technique had already been attempted in Flanders, and it was soon to be extended into many other areas of France. The idea was simple but bloody effective. The English king sought to intervene in ongoing private disputes between the Valois dynasty and their feudal vassals, thus creating new allies, challenging Philip VI's rights as overlord of France, and scattering and above all dissipating France's powerful military resources. Indeed, because Edward had claimed the throne of France, this allowed him to create alternative feudal relationships with the dukes and counts of that country. and a huge levy on the wool trade in the intervening years gave the king working capital to start fighting again. After an inconclusive campaign in Brittany in 1342, the king decided to launch a major continental offensive involving simultaneous attacks on several different fronts. In 1345, Henry of Grosmont and the Earl of Northampton were sent with expeditionary forces to Aquitaine and Brittany. And while these two were fighting, a third prong of this massive three-prong attack was led by the king into a short campaign into Flanders. And then the following year, a baron from Normandy called Geoffrey de Harcon appealed to Edward III for assistance in his private dispute with the Valois regime. The king immediately sailed for Normandy with an army of about 15,000 men. In the hot, glorious summer of 1346, Edward III arrived in France and brought hell on earth to the north coast of Normandy. As his army marched, as far as the eye could see, all was death and carnage. Fields were lit up in flickering oranges and yellows as the English burned crops. Towns and villages lay smashed and looted and abandoned. From the Normandy coast south fled these terrified refugees, fleeing the angels of death as they destroyed anything and everything they encountered. As this army travelled, they spread out across the fertile Norman countryside and ended up creating a front at one point between 12 and 15 miles wide at times. And they burned and destroyed literally anything they came across. That summer, the air in Normandy was thick with choking smoke and loud with the screams of those villagers who had been too slow to escape. And as that army marched along inland, 200 ships of an English navy hugged the Normandy coast, supplying provisions for the army as long as they remained close enough, but also disembarking to destroy every small port and harbour they encountered. One royal clerk estimated that literally everything within 5 miles of the coastline had been ruined or plundered by this English horde. Way back in chapter 81 of The Story of London, I described when King John, the last king of England to own Normandy, had been driven from these lands by the French raiding their way north. Now Edward III, John's great-great-grandson, was returning the favour to the French, leading eventually around 10,000 men eastward across the Duchy of Normandy towards the River Seine and towards the two great cities of Rouen and Paris. Edward I had now totally dropped his old-fashioned strategy of alliance building in Flanders. Alliances were too bloody expensive. All that had ever given him was bankruptcy, and all that had done was cause the fall of the Bardies of Florence. By 1346, Edward's only allies really were a small pro-English faction of nobles in Brittany and a small pro-English faction of Flemish nobles. All of which meant that, bottom line, every man fighting under his royal arms in 1346 came from England. They came from all over the country. They all spoke the same language. They all cried the same battle cry of Saint George. Perhaps half of them were archers trained in their home villages to fire a deadly longbow with great accuracy. Included amidst them were engineers and miners, clerks and servants, residents of the countryside and residents of towns. Many had been pressed into compulsory service by the system of array, and some were criminals pardoned for their crimes in return for serving in the field. And without any doubt, really, we can be sure that several of these brutal angels of death had come from London. All were equipped and provisioned with a huge wealth of supplies and weapons compulsory purchased in a fearsome war drive, an army noted for their uniformly white-painted arrows and bows. This force, as it marched east, was divided into three. The rearguard was marshalled by the Bishop of Durham, the exceptionally martial Thomas Hatfield. The king commanded the middle section, but the vanguard was nominally led by Edward's eldest son, Edward, Prince of Wales and Duke of Cornwall. He was 16 years old this summer, tall and striking, already seeming a brave young man in the same mould as his father. He'd been knighted as soon as he had landed from a ship on the Normandy coast, along with some other young men of the campaign, William Montagu, the son of the Earl of Salisbury, and Roger Mortimer, the grandson of the original Roger Mortimer. The Earls of Northampton and Warwick rode at the Earl of Cornwall's side to guide his hand. This campaign was to be the making of him. King Edward's operational security and counterintelligence for this campaign had been brilliant. Philip VI had received false information that the king had intended to make for Gascony to reinforce Henry Grosmont deep in the southwest of France. Thus, when Edward's main invasion force landed, they had found the region largely undefended. His army reached Cairn on the 26th of July. They ignored the fortress there, but stormed the rich suburbs of the city in an orgy of murder, rapine and kidnapping. Over 2,500 residents were killed, and countless others sent back to England for ransom. After the bloodbath at Cairn, the English Angels of Death marched along the south bank of the River Seine for another fortnight. A French army was desperately assembled and moved into position. It broke the bridges across the river to prevent the English from crossing it and shattered the invaders along the north bank while awaiting reinforcements. By the 12th of August, the English were within 20 miles of Paris. In the great French capital, a panic broke out as the residents realised how close and how brutal the English were. Down the Seine, smoke could be seen rising from nearby towns these angels of death had visited. King Philip of France was compelled to summon men-at-arms to keep the peace in the largest city in Europe, as in the suburbs and the city itself, residents barricaded their doors and sought to prepare for the inevitable. The panic grew when word arrived that the English king had his men build a bridge across the Seine to get to the north bank. Philip VI sat with his advisers and basically panicked. Desperate to keep the English at bay, Philip marched a large army to a region 4 miles south of Paris and there tried to make themselves look attackable. But Edward did not take the bait. He decided not to march south to give battle with the French or east to besiege Paris. Instead, he surprised the French by crossing the river and heading directly north. What they did not know was that he was hoping to team up with the Flemish army marching south and supposedly based around Bethune. Yet, after travelling fast for a week, the French trying to catch up and gathering forces as they did, thus forcing Edward to push his men harder, their foes discovering in their wake that this English horde had left the French countryside stripped and bare of all food and supplies, Edward's men discovered to their dismay that the Flemish army had given up and gone home. And in desperation, the French army coming up hard at their heels meant that a battle was inevitable. The English and French finally met before a forest between the villages of Crécy and Wandicoot on Saturday, the 26th of August, 1346. The English were arrayed in two lines of infantry and men-at-arms. Everybody was fighting on foot. There may have been knights, but nobody was on horseback for this battle. The Earl of Cornwall was commanding the front line with the Earls of Warwick and Northampton beside him. This day was to be the start of the legend of the Black Prince. Behind him, the king took command of the rearguard, laughing and joking with them as he did so. On either side of these blocks of infantry, then, were two huge additional blocks of archers, also dismounted from their horses, and they were surrounded by the baggage carts to protect them against cavalry charges. And there the English sat. The French arrived at Crécy in dribs and drabs, but they comfortably and overwhelmingly outnumbered the English. Philip VI had about 25,000 men in the field, they say, including a large number of Genoese mercenaries. The French king arranged his men in 5 battalions. He put the crossbowmen at the front, with 2 divisions of cavalry behind them, and this force was flanked on either side by his massed infantry. A standoff began. The French maybe thought the English would charge them, but the tactics the English had learned in Scotland now played out here in France. The English stayed still. They shouted insults at the French. The French shouted insults back. The defenders' forces grew as the day went on, increasingly outnumbering the English. And then, at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, it began to rain heavily. And at this, there was a sudden beating of drums and a blaring of bugles, and the Genoese crossbowmen stepped forward to fire upon the English. And the English longbowmen responded. The English arrows were lethal, fired at a rate of 5 or 6 per archer per minute. They fell from the sky like a blizzard. The crossbow bolts of Philip's Genoese mercenaries, meanwhile, well, they could only fire at less than half that rate, and they fell short of their targets. The Genoese faltered, and the mighty French cavalry saw this and took their faltering for cowardice. The 1st Battalion charged in fury and in contempt at the English opposing them. But the longbowmen kept up the blizzards of white arrows. The air was filled with a sickening sound of heavy wooden bolts slamming into men and horse flesh. Horses reared and threw their riders. Others' horses crashed into them. And those who continued faced wave after wave of arrows, and the death toll began to rise. And as the arrows whipped through the air, so Edward III ordered another weapon unleashed. For the first time on the battlefields of France, cannon fire was supposedly heard. The English had brought several cannons to the field, primitive devices that used gunpowder to shoot metal balls. Were these the same ones which had been sat in London for the last decade, practiced upon by Londoners who now understood how these wild machines worked? There is nothing to say they were. But neither does anything say specifically that they were not. It remains a possibility. And so for the purpose of this story, actual historians, I hope, will forgive me, that as a narrator I claim that they certainly were the cannons of London, and the cannons that had been fired in Guildhall, crewed by London men who had trained on them, now fired at the French. However impressive these cannons were, they were not as deadly as the longbows. But they added the roar of guns to the whistle of arrows, which was added to the manly screams of injured men, which was added to the terrified animalistic shrieks of wounded horses, and the battlefield became a muddy miasma of hell itself. Several hours of fierce, bloody fighting followed, and the French were utterly routed. Their cavalry, their knights were magnificent. Skilled horsemen regrouped and recharged with insane amounts of bravery. But the French were discovering the lesson the English had learned at the Battle of Bannockburn, and the Scots had learnt in the years before. The French lost thousands upon thousands of men. 1,542 knights and squires were counted amongst the dead by the English front line, and the losses amongst the ordinary soldiers were said to be uncountable and innumerable. Many important nobles allied to Philip's cause lost their lives during this battle, including the blind King John of Bohemia. The victory was staggering. Edward sent news of the victory at Crecy back to England, claiming in a letter to Parliament that the whole host of France had been destroyed. London, with its proximity both to Westminster and to the giant Blackfriars Priory, the headquarters of the Dominican monks, an order who moonlighted in distributing news across the kingdom, had been amongst the first to hear of the victory. Crecy was unexpected and amazing. It erupted on the streets like winning the World Cup. It offered some vindication and benediction for all the hardships faced by the English people who had paid for this rampaging army heavily. In terms of propaganda alone, it was the most important battle won by someone claiming to be a King of England since Hastings. And it was not the only good news. That October, Northern English forces routed a massive Scottish invading army at the Battle of Neville's Cross in County Durham. Almost the entire military leadership of Scotland was removed in a single day, either killed or captured, and King David II himself was captured and brought to England there to remain a prisoner for over a decade. This news was spectacular. However, for all the good news, the victories of 1346 did not settle this war. Although his army had inflicted a crushing defeat upon the French king, Edward's victory at Crécy did not destroy French military capability or curb Philip's overall political power. And so the two sides remained in the field for the remainder of the year. For the rest of the summer, the Earl of Lancaster continued to command action around Gascony, and Sir Thomas Dagworth won a brilliant victory in Brittany, where he defeated and captured Charles of Blois. And then in September 1346, Edward and his son Edward began a brutal and terrible siege of Calais, which lasted until October 1347. This year-long siege was in actuality an even greater military event than the Battle of Crécy. Almost 26,000 Englishmen took part, the largest English army that would ever take the field during the entire history of the Hundred Years' War. With the exception of those too old or sick to attend, every single English earl was present at some point during that mammoth siege. It cost a veritable fortune to maintain such a massive army. But the victory at Crécy had transformed Edward's status. The Siege of Calais became a national gathering of the new massive army of England, a huge dark pageant of chivalry, with the king and his glorious blood-soaked son now crowned in glory, and all this hiding the fact that this was basically a murderous, hostile invading army, and their displays were taking place as they ground the town of Calais into submission. Inside the townsfolk tried to hold out, but starvation began. It is said they grew so hungry they began to chew the leather from their saddles. And yet Calais held out for a year, during which King Philip VI tried to goad the English king into leaving Calais by bringing his armies close enough that he hoped Edward would come out to fight him. Edward wasn't biting, and if Philip wanted him so badly, he could come meet him here in Calais. Eventually, in October 1347, when it became clear that the English could not and would not leave, a deputation of citizens emerged to give up Calais to Edward, wearing nooses around their necks to symbolise their utter surrender. What followed then was pure propaganda, a carefully choreographed show of chivalric mercy. King Edward allowed Queen Philippa to plead successfully for his clemency. The starving residents of Calais were spared, and Calais was seized and became part of England so deeply that it will remain part of England for the next two centuries, and London was to maintain an especially close relationship with it, as we will see. The king and his companions returned to England in late 1347 as conquering heroes, and it was felt by all that this glorious king could only but build upon this. And yet, as 1348 dawned, and London basked in the psychological joy of this victory, something stirred. The real angel of death had seemingly awoken, and wearing his crown of pestilence, he began his majestic procession from the Asian steppes towards Europe. Many centuries before, a disease had crossed Europe. It had left countless dead, but its memory was long forgotten. We mentioned it all the way back in Chapter 3 of the Story of London. In the then Eastern Roman Empire, it had been called the Justinian Plague. Far to the west, amongst the scattered survivors of the old Roman province of Britannia, the people there, the Welsh, had referred to this as the Great Mortality. But these moments were long gone and forgotten, yet the same disease now reached the edges of Europe and built for its scythe to fall upon the continent. And all of this victory, all of this glory, all of that life that was to be found in London, now came under its shadow. The angel of death, in the form of plague, was coming to London. And the new great mortality began. Okay, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again next week for another episode of The Story of London, as we come to the concluding chapter of Book 4, and we meet the Black Death. Thanks for listening. Bye.